This is Seismic Sessions, enabling the financial services industry, a podcast show dedicated to two things, revenue enablement and the financial services sector. Join us as we feature experts and leaders across the financial services industry who discuss innovative and impactful ways to sell, market and deliver memorable client experiences through enablement. Let's get this Seismic Session started.
Welcome to the Seismic Sessions podcast, where we explore the stories, strategies, and innovations shaping the future of financial services. I'm Rachel Rowe, Regional Vice President at Seismic, and I'm thrilled to be your host today alongside my wonderful co-host, Gemma Livermore.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm Gemma Livermore, Head of Financial Services Marketing at Seismic, and together we are here today to uncover how partnerships are driving transformation in the financial services industry. For me, this is a really exciting topic, and we've got two incredible guests joining us today.
That's right, Gemma. We're delighted to welcome Ezra Demir and Marcus Martinez to the show today. So if I could ask you both to please introduce yourselves to our listeners, and Ezra, if I start with you.
Yeah, sure. Pleasure to be here. Ezra Demir. I'm heading up our digital partnerships practice in HSBC. I'm part of a group called Emerging Technology, Innovation and Ventures, and currently based in London.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Marcus?
Well, thanks for having me. So Marcus Martinez, I'm an industry advisor at Microsoft, working mostly with banks in the EMEA region. So it's great to connect.
Wonderful. Thanks for both being here today. We start off every single podcast by asking our guests what enabling financial services means to them. It means something different to virtually everybody that we've had on the show. So I like this part. Ezra, if we can go to you first.
I've been thinking about it and I said, banks and financial institutions exist because money exists. And money exists because we wanted to have an efficient way of storing and exchanging value. And for me, enablement is about actually creating that value and being the partner in creating that value.
Nice. I like that. Marcus?
Yeah, I think for me is about integration with the customer lifestyle or the business owner lifestyle. I think most of the history of financial services is about friction for good reasons, you know, to manage risk, to be compliant. I think where we see the market going is when financial services almost become invisible. And that means that it's fully integrated with your lifestyle. Think like getting an Uber car from going from point A to point B. You don't think about the geolocation. You don't think about the payment aspect. You just want to access some form of utility. I know we are far from that, but to me, that's the ultimate purpose of FSI. And I think over the next 24 months, I think will be even more important because we need to find new drivers of prosperity. And in my mind, these will come from the smaller business, which comprises 99% of the economy. So I think that's the goal, drive prosperity and, you know, integrate with our lifestyles.
I like that. And that enablement's really coming across. Like, although you say we're not there yet, I was quite amazed that recently I went to Switzerland and it was the first time I'd been to another country and not touched a single piece of the local currency. And I came back and I was like, wow, that really was frictionless, to your point.
Yeah. I agree. I used to collect currencies.
Oh yeah, same.
Now I have none. Sometimes you go to a country, then you just forget that you actually need a wallet and cash. You can't just keep paying with your, like, tapping your phone.
I also like the invisible aspect because, you know, it's the old adage, people don't want a mortgage. They actually want to buy a house. And it's around the outcomes that we're looking to drive with financial services.
I think probably the most interesting example, it's probably the web, the internet. I remember when that was a thing. And today, nobody talks about the internet. It's just something that exists, you know? So it's the same thing. It becomes invisible.
For sure. For those that have listened to our podcast before, you'll know we follow the same structure on every conversation. And we use seismic terminology. So we look at the tremors, and that's where we look back at where the movements of change began. At the epicenter, where we are now. And then we look at the aftershocks, which is my favourite part, because it's the blue sky thinking of where we think things are going to shake up in the future.
And this framework will guide us as we explore not just the innovations that are happening now, which we're already starting to unpack a little bit, but also the broader context and future opportunities which are shaping the industry. So let's start with the tremors. First question to you, Ezra. You've been instrumental in fostering partnerships between startups and tech giants. How have these partnerships evolved to meet the demands of the financial services sector?
I think if you go maybe not too far behind, but 5 years ago, you would think that it would be only a few select really cool senior leaders who have a clue what they're doing and they are very well connected. They would explore this type of ideas. It wouldn't be mainstream. Now, this is where we started from. And then I think some of us started to realize this is something good to explore. A few things happened. As the financial institutions, especially with organizations like mine, with legacy platforms and having footprint in so many different jurisdictions and having so many complex requirements, you needed to find more innovative solutions. And sometimes the pace of change you needed to go through was not fulfilled by the pace of change. You can do it alone. So you needed to seek partnerships. And those partnerships started to come from either tech giants because you have that trusted relationship, or it needed to come from your portfolio companies through your ventures or some other startups that you're exploring certain things together because they were niche enough to do that.
Yeah, makes sense. Marcus, with your extensive experience advising tier one financial institutions, how have partnerships with the tech companies helped transform that traditional banking operation?
There's a long-term trend that we have seen in financial services where maybe 50 years ago, a bank, you know, the usual suspects like HSBC, Barclays, Lloyds, would need the technology to improve the operating models. However, at that time, technology was super expensive, so you have to do it yourself. And that was what we call operating like a black box, but like in silos. Everything inside the organization is built by, you know, the organization itself. With the advent of the web, we start to see that the bar to enter this market was much, much lower because suddenly, if you knew as an entrepreneur that lending, commercial lending underwriting was a problem for a bank, you'd say, well, actually, I have access to the technology now. I have access to clouds. Maybe I can do that 10 times better and 10 times cheaper. And that's the reality today. So whatever any bank is thinking about doing is highly, highly likely there's someone in the fintech ecosystem doing exactly that 10 times better and 10 times cheaper. And that created a new source of complexity because now you have a bank which has a lot of, let's say, business logic inside, and that needs to be externalized to create partnerships. And that's, I think we're still there yet to some extent, like trying to reassess the way we do things inside the bank and say, actually, that is so overly complicated to your point about legacy. But there's a better way. And that's, I think, is what's triggering, you know, partnerships.
I think we've been challenged. And instead of being beaten, we chose to partner.
Yeah. Well, yeah, interesting you say that. Yeah. Interesting.
It's interesting when you look at the journey, isn't it? Because we saw a huge explosion of fintech and we had incubators and banks seeding their own incubators. And you talked a bit about, you know, their portfolio companies, et cetera, and looking to find solutions that way. And I think more recently, we're seeing much stronger ecosystem development where it's much more of an open sharing of technology. How are you seeing that in the current kind of climate?
I think there is no single world innovation left or will be left soon. I think we will need to consider it as towards open innovation. So I don't see us having an isolated funnel of ideas coming through a journey and getting into production and scale. I think we will need to cross-pollinate internally and externally on an open platform. So I do not think we can continue to take a bigger slice from the same pie. We need to work together to grow the pie.
Okay. Yeah. So you look at that maturity level rather than when we look back at the tremors, it's where the partnership starts. And then maybe as we move into the epicenter, it's how you mature those ones that you already have.
Correct.
I like that.
I think there's an interesting complexity that emerges from this kind of situation, because when you think about partnerships that are established between large organizations and the fintech space, or even outside fintech, you start to create a completely new level of complexity. And that requires a new, different way of thinking about how to operate a bank. Because suddenly it's not necessarily about, it's almost like the difference between building a Lego brick one by one or reusing Lego bricks that exist and assembling them in a different way. And there's no limitations. You think about music, or if you get a piano, there's a fixed amount of, you know, keys there that you can play a music, but there's no limitation of music that can be played. So in banking, I think it's exactly the same thing. So it doesn't matter if two banks, two competitors using the same, you know, fintech or the same solution, because the differentiation will come from the way you assemble these propositions.
I like that they're using the same piano but playing different music.
Exactly, exactly. And I don't think there's a limitation for that, because not everything inside the bank will be, let's say, replaced, but whatever is happening outside. So if you got an organization like HSBC, there's so much intelligence inside that is just the source of their competitive advantage. That will never become something that a fintech will do. And I think that's probably the challenge, is find that kind of balance. How much you allow to be, let's say, outsourced versus what you keep inside that makes it different. I think that's probably the struggle that's ongoing.
And as we move into the epicenter side, what do you think are the key milestones that we've been through until we get to today that have really shaped that digital financial ecosystem that we sit in now?
For me, two things come to mind is open banking and cloud adoption. Open banking, because when the external bodies governing you start to say that you will need to have standardized application interfaces, you have no choice to give it. The moment one of the organizations start giving it and the customers, consumers, users start understanding what it means for them, then it becomes an external pressure on you to adopt and provide. I think that was one inflection point in my mind. And the second one is, maybe it was a shift. It's not an inflection point of so much, but cloud being widely adopted and trusted.
Yes. Yeah. The trust was a huge shift, wasn't it?
I agree. I love the open banking analogy. I think it's something that is probably underappreciated in the industry. This regulatory framework to exchange data, cloud, well, that's music to my ears. And I would add another one, which is the mobile, the smartphone, which for me, that's such a very interesting thing, because when you think about the smartphone, everything you can do today with your this device, it creates a pressure on the industry to become more contextual. Because now, I don't remember, I think it was Deloitte's CEO said some time ago that the busiest branch was the Blackfriars train at 7 a.m. because everybody's using the app at that stage, at that moment in time. So I think for me, that the reason this is a milestone is because it forces the bank to be contextual and consider new types of data. So for example, if you think about historically, having your geolocation at this moment in time wasn't that important, right? It wasn't irrelevant. But when you think about fraud, right, there are solutions in the market that will say, you know, what angle Marcus is holding his phone, or how quick is the keystroke, you know, is he walking? And all this, you know, data in smartphone becomes something that banks are using to detect fraud. And so I think for me, this will keep going because the smartphone is becoming more powerful. And of course, like how many minutes we're running without talking about AI, right? Mm-hmm. And I think last year with the, let's say, the open launch of GPT-3 or 3.5, that was something that I think we're still seeing the consequences.
And it's really interesting as you're talking through these milestones, it's just occurring to me that there's a greater degree of collaboration as we go along that timeline. So that if we move to the epicenter, because I feel that the history to some extent is relatively short, and it's where we are now in the future, which is really the main focus. So if we think about collaboration as a catalyst for innovation, I guess, Marcus, if I start with you, what role do you see partnerships playing in driving innovation within areas like payment systems, customer experience, regulatory compliance? We started to kind of dance around some of these a little bit, but maybe if you could share some specific examples.
Yeah, I think there's a interesting, not dependency, but synergy between fintechs and tier one and tier two banks. I think the first one is about industry domain knowledge. So even though a bank may decide to build a specific solution for a specific problem, that's not the main purpose of a bank, right? So that's why I question sometimes the scale of technology teams in banks. Because a financial institution, as far as, you know, from a historical perspective, of course, they need to have a big muscle to deliver tech. And I think the way partners add value to this relationship is by bringing this domain knowledge. As I said before, they're doing probably something 10 times better, 10 times cheaper. And that creates a lot of value. And I think the other thing is around how to say that is the resilience aspect. So when you think about a bank in the traditional operating model where you have everything, not everything, but most of the capabilities in-house, it's almost like a honeypot. There are many things that can go wrong just because of the complexity. So when you create a more decentralized operating model, as a consequence, your operational resilience goes up because not everything is inside the same institution. And I know there's a debate about, you know, the degree of dependency, locking effects. There's like a whole new topic. But I think top of mind for me, that'll be the main two things, the value and the operational resilience.
Definitely. And Ezra, how about we now talk about meaningful innovation? Because obviously innovation can take us off into so many different directions. How do you ensure that partnerships between banks and tech companies lead to that meaningful innovation?
For me, I think ChatGPT was a good test because we've been working with Microsoft when they announced their partnership with OpenAI. I was super excited to understand what GPT can do in the context of financial services. And when I was trying to explain it within the organization, it was a different journey versus the moment ChatGPT was launched and public knowledge, the amount of requests that was incoming to me and my team was completely different. And that then presents itself beautifully as a problem and therefore an opportunity to solve is people then out of a sudden found a very nice hammer and looking for their own nails. For me, I think the most important thing is that what is the problem that we are falling in love? And I think most organizations, most teams, most people make the mistake of falling in love with a solution.
Before finding the problem?
Correct. So I think the problem and or the opportunity, it could either present itself as a problem to you or an opportunity, is the most important thing. And then when somebody wants to work in partnership, because I see myself as the enabler of the partnership with big technology companies and my company, and therefore, I would ask, what is the opportunity or problem we would like to solve? Is this a real one? Do we have the data? And why in partnership with that organization? What's in it for them? And what is the superpower that we are leveraging from them? And then is the initiative then for will create the trifecta of value? The end user will benefit from it. My organization and the partner organization will benefit from it. It will either provide a solution at scale, or it will be scalable. And the last but not least is the blueprint. Because I don't think we should do something because it's novel and fancy and one-off. I think we should do repeatable, reusable things and therefore it become innovation. Because otherwise, it conflicts with my two internal design principles. It needs to be sustainable and it needs to help grow the pie together.
I guess that's where the partnership element comes in. And when we earlier on looked at how things used to be, it was just a one-hit wonder of solving a problem. Whereas now it's more about having a partner that grows with you and works with you as you grow.
And I think previously, going back to the beginnings of the partnerships, I think if we were buying a solution from a tech company, big or small, it would consider quote-unquote partnerships. For me, it's just a transaction. Yeah. The true partnership is that do we have that conversation that the technology company goes and therefore builds the right product and capability? Yeah. Do we then have the right support from the technology company to turn it into a solution using our internal know-how? And then it becomes a partnership. Otherwise, it's a mere sales transaction.
Yeah. And what do you look for when you're trying to discover whether someone is just a transactional solution as opposed to a partner? What is it that you see there?
I think the uniqueness is, again, so unique. It's not different than what I look, whether it's a meaningful innovation. It's still about the user, whether user as an individual banking customer or as a corporate client that we are serving. Or maybe it is something that would be a user of the technology company. So let's say we are working on a maps-related, geolocation-related project and we will innovate together. Will the end, like ultimate maps user will benefit from it?
Yeah, if I add to that, I think there are two elements that I like to consider as well. I think one is around the value that delivers for the customer. And what I mean by that is the level of intimacy that the solution enables. Because, for example, when you serve a customer, regardless of the product, there's a specific amount of data about the customer that you consider to provide that service or to sell that product. I think what I have seen as a trend is that good solutions provide a higher level of resolution about the customer, almost in a way that you can anticipate intent. But the other side of the coin, which is the employee experience as well. And for me, this is pretty much two sides of the same coin. So are you enabling this value to be created? Are you enabling this customer experience? But what's the impact for people working inside the bank? Is that making them save more time? Is making the work more interesting? And I think these two things go hand in hand and is a key factor, I think, to consider partnerships as well.
Definitely. And Rachel, I'd love to bring in your viewpoints at this stage because I know you work for a lot of tier one banks and see what partnership looks like from the other side. Give both sides of the story, if you like. So how does Seismic enhance the success of these partnerships when you get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the framing here because I think for us, it's all about really creating process improvement and or solving for an identified problem, to your point, Ezra. And if we look at Microsoft, for example, Seismic's built on Azure, so we enjoy a really close relationship with Microsoft. Microsoft really drives productivity across the organization. With Seismic, we are laser focused on go-to-market effectiveness. So if we look at one particular use case, so let's talk about Seismic meetings, for example. We address the cycle of prepare, present, and follow up. And within that, we use content, skills, learning, and enablement all within the Seismic cloud. The intention is, I would say, is threefold. The first is to meet the seller where they are, so that, you know, they're not going from one environment to another. It's frictionless in terms of the seller experience. We're really providing the tools to accelerate the sales cycle so that, you know, there is an end aspiration and we're looking to help drive revenue. And then finally, we really provide that critical data and insights to drive those feedback loops. We've only touched on AI. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to come. As we know, data is a key piece of that, and having confidence and understanding you have quality of data is really important. And all of this within the spirit of continual improvement, because I think, to your point about strategic partner as opposed to someone providing you with a point solution, once you've solved that problem, was it that problem you were trying to solve, or is that actually masking something bigger behind it that is now exposed that you need to address? And I think it's having confidence that you have the partners in place to help you evolve and grow as an organization and kind of co-create the solutions that help drive your business forward. So I guess that moves to the future.
I'd just like to touch there. I really like even the language that has changed in our industry as you look at these things. You know, you look at things like co-pilot enablement. It talks about that shared goal, that you're doing it together. You know, you're going to make someone's life easier. And to your point that you said earlier, you know, it's working together for that same goal and growing together. So I've really noticed a shift in language, which is worth touching on, I think. But yes, my favourite part, the aftershock. I love this bit because it's all the blue sky thinking, and I love hearing what people think is going to happen in the future. So yeah, Rachel.
Excellent. Yeah, so the aftershocks. So let's look at the future of financial innovation through partnerships. And Ezra, if I start with you. So as you look ahead, what trends do you see shaping the future of partnerships in financial services? Quite a broad question, so you can take it where you like.
I would like to give one example, which is a tangent. However, it's important in the way of thinking. So if you pay attention how the London city is shaping itself to prepare itself for bigger innovation cycles coming in, and some guidances that's been given the universities, even the physical buildings, the way that they need to build, needs to have public facing levels and venues for public to intermingle with academia, which goes back to open innovation, which goes back to your question for financial partnerships and innovation in the future to be successful. We need to now start breaking that thinking on the boundaries of us being a highly regulated industry to a highly connected industry. I think it needs to manifest even the way that we present ourselves in the physical world. Do we have spaces where our clients and customers comes and sits and works with us on the solutions and the problems? That is the client and customer aspect. On the partnership aspect with the technology companies, the startups, scale-ups, big tech, it's about, do we ask each other the incisive questions, which might be uncomfortable to ask and or answer today, and willing to go on that long-term journey? Because let's be honest, all of us are incentivized with certain shorter-term cycles. We are publicly traded. We have investors, we have society, we have our own employees, own leaders to answer to. How we will be making that work for us to have that strategic, incisive, bold questions asked and answered together on the long run.
And that's where growth happens, isn't it? It's in those uncomfortable questions that people might not want to ask, so they are important.
And that will be the point we will start solving the exact root cause of the problems instead of treating the symptoms.
Yeah. Marcus, how can banks continue to leverage tech partnerships to stay competitive? Obviously, we've touched on AI and cloud computing, and that's going to have a big impact as we look into the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think these probably are the foundations of, you know, partnerships going forward. The reason I say that is because over the last 10 years, we have been creating this massive ecosystem of partners, which Seismic is part of. And there are loads of advantages by leveraging Microsoft Azure Marketplace.
That's what I was going to touch on. I love the way that not only do you partner with banks, but you then bring in other technologies to partner with those banks, with the marketplace. Yeah. If we could touch on that.
Yeah, we have seen a lot of traction recently on transactions through marketplace.
Could we explain for our listeners who might not know what it is, what the marketplace is and how MACH agreements work?
So think about the app store you have in your mobile, yeah. Right? It's the same concept, but for our enterprise. So you have these, let's say, apps available in Azure where you can easily integrate with your, you know, applications inside the bank. So it's not a plug and play process, but compared to the other scenario where you source the application separately, it's much, much simpler from a commercial and technical perspective. So the Azure Marketplace provides this breadth and depth of applications across many, many domains and across many, many industries.
So just as an example for listeners to explain a little bit further, some of our clients have a MACH agreement with you and then they go into the Azure Marketplace and they buy Seismic in that marketplace in the same way. I buy lots on Amazon. Don't tell my partner. But it makes it that easy and accessible.
And actually that decrements the consumption, the MACH as well with banks. So that's something we have seen a lot of traction. And of course, the AI aspect is another thing. So when you think about, you know, using a large language model today, it does require a huge, you know, capital investment. And it's not something that makes sense for an institution to do that separately. So by leveraging cloud and all the AI capabilities inside, it really helps you as an organization to focus on what you do, which is providing financial services, not necessarily building a large language model. And I think talking about AI, we have over the last, you know, few years adding 1,800, you know, models on our cloud. So if you're thinking about depending on the problem you want to solve, there's of course GPT, but there are many others like Mistral, like Llama, Phi, these small language models. So when you think about this environment or this infrastructure, it really gives you all the ingredients for you to be innovative. And I think that's how we, see ourselves as how, you know, are we enabling people and the organizations to be more innovative?
I think that's going to be a huge thing in the future. You know, it comes back to what we said at the beginning, isn't it? It's taking away that friction. So allowing people to grow in an innovative way and in a very easy way without any friction.
And the other thing I'll add there is the cost of experimentation as well, because that's one of the interesting things when you work with, you know, big hyperscalers, is that the cost of experimentation is really low. Like if the product doesn't fly, that's absolutely fine, because, you know, all the things are pretty much an API or an integration layer. It's not something that you have to rebuild from scratch. So, and I think that's your point about innovation. I think that's where probably our industry needs to change the mindset, because historically, we are afraid of mistakes for good reasons, right? We are a financial services industry. We cannot make mistakes. But with this kind of infrastructure, you do lower the cost of mistakes. Yeah. And that falls now within your risk appetite as a bank. So I think that's probably one of the key things that we need to consider.
I could go off on a tangent here, so I'm looking down to keep myself on track.
Good.
I love this part. Rachel, how will Seismic's offerings evolve in that aspect to support like growing needs of financial institutions and their partners?
Yeah, really good question. Innovation is in our DNA. You know, we are a technology company at the end of the day. And as you mentioned, we are privileged to have over 400 financial services customers. And amongst those, we have 24 of the 25 largest asset managers. Just throwing some numbers out because I know we're all kind of essentially numbers people at heart. But what that does mean is that we have a solid foundation to draw upon to help drive our innovation. So we are looking to do the adjacent possible in terms of what we have today, where we could be tomorrow. And we do a lot of co-creation with our existing customer base as well. We have a very flexible, extensible platform, and so we are able to build in requirements of market-leading organizations, and in many cases that then becomes the next evolution of our solution. But I guess underpinning that, the key trends that we see within financial services really are that this need for hyper-personalization, I think that's something that we all recognize. You've talked about kind of this frictionless FS experience. The need to do more with less, which is being driven by this complex economic environment in which we find ourselves. And I think as a corollary of that, and perhaps also of AI, a need to simplify the tech stack so that you have confidence in your data and you don't have an amorphous technology estate where, you know, you have black holes and you're not quite sure where the insights are that you need. And then underpinning this, obviously, it's all driven by AI-enhanced workflows. So to bring all this together in a meaningful way, we put our customers at the center of what we do. That's the lens through which we view the world. And really, it's enabling our customers to evolve their customer experience to deliver a world-class experience. Because I think really, particularly in FS, you know, we have an environment where you've got shrinking margins, there's cost pressure, you know, there's a very intense competition. And CX is really that battleground and where, you know, the competitive advantage is being sought. And so that is where we really help to move the needle. So,
and something as we look into the future that I think is going to be invaluable as all of this grows are those feedback loops that you mentioned earlier and using technology to see what is working, especially when you're looking at being client-centric, what's landing well, what's working with them, so that you can fail fast. To your point that you said earlier, Marcus, you know, having that risk appetite to do it, but within a budget. So that I think that that ability to look at engagement levels and have those feedback loops is going to be so imperative, especially when we look at the next generation of customer experiences and what that looks like. We went to a talk recently where, and I'm looking at Rachel as I say that, where we learned that there's first time ever that there's five generations in the workforce at the moment. And when you think each of them have a very different way of wanting to work and take on financial services. So that's going to be really important. Is there anything you'd like to add on that level?
That was exactly what I was thinking, because statistically, all of us in this room are expected to live above 100 years of age, which means we will need to think of the long-term, long game. And the question about the importance of collaborating, partnering, it's about as simple as we can go fast alone or we can go further together. And I feel like we have no option but to bet for the longer term.
Well said. Well said. And I think as we wrap up, I'd like to get from both of you your final reflections on the importance of collaboration in driving financial innovation. So if I start with you, Marcus, this time.
Yeah, I think that's something that it depends how you define collaboration, because I think that's the meaning is changing because of AI. So when you think about collaboration, I think we think about collaboration between people, which I think it's super important. But to me now, there's also the collaboration with the machine, with AI. And the reason I say that is because many of the problems we face today in our industry, I think the complexity surpass our human capacity to think or reason on top of that. And that's why we do brainstorming sessions to, you know, we have a problem and we need ideas. But doing brainstorming sessions, you cannot do a brainstorming session with, you know, every single problem you face. But today you can, right? Because if you have, for example, Copilot working with you, and I do that every day to say, well, I think that's a good idea. Give me 10 reasons why this is a bad idea. Yeah. And suddenly Copilot will say, actually, you missed all these points. And I keep on that loop until suddenly, you know, I end up with an idea that was much better than I was just sitting in front of the computer and trying to articulate my thoughts. So to me, that's a similar construct when you think about large organizations and smaller organizations, because, and I mean partners, fintechs, because this feedback loop is becoming more efficient. So when you think about historically, for an organization to change their product, like the release cycle will be really, really long, just because of all the inherent complexity of the process. But today, if you have an AI agent embedded in your application, as a partner, you can say, actually, there's this use case or this feature that we haven't thought about, but suddenly it's becoming important for this customer. And that feedback loop becomes much, much smoother and I think easier to manage. And I think that's what we're going. So collaboration for me is really, of course, keeping these human connections. But I think there's a new actor on the scene now, which is the AI. So for me, I think that's something we discussed a few weeks ago about the creativity imperative. So in my mind, I think we are in an industry that's highly analytical for good reasons. But I think all these things that are really analytical, very structured, I think AI is just taking over. It's just a matter of time. The only thing really that where I think will really, really differentiate is by bringing our human, you know, creativity and, you know, ingenuity.
And EQ may now become more important than IQ, because you're bringing that part to apply it along. Cheers. Yeah. And I love to see, as somebody who supports diversity and inclusion, I love to see where that will take us.
Yeah.
I think my thoughts were on a different landscape, but I was thinking about us being sort of systematically important in the size and scale that we represent for our own organizations. Our organizations in the industries they operate, they are systematically important, which is a privilege and a duty. Because in this age of AI, I think some of the barriers will be lowered while some of them will be higher. And it's on us to make sure our societies, customers, clients, investors do not get hurt. And then we are the voice that needs to be heard. And we are also the custodian for the data, for the value, for the information. And we are the true enabler of that value creation and exchange. So that's where my thoughts are for the future in partnership.
Yeah. And I like the fact that you frame it as a privilege as well as a duty, because it puts that positive, yeah.
I love that. And I really like the theme that's gone through this whole conversation, which has really been about collaboration and partnerships and, you know, working together to develop greater value. And I guess I would like to wrap up inviting our listeners to explore a little bit how Seismic can help streamline and enhance their partnership strategies. So most of our customers have invested heavily in their strategic tech pillars. So Microsoft, Salesforce, Snowflake, whatever it may be. With Seismic, it's not about adding more, it's about unlocking the value of the potential that you have within those pillars. So we're scalable, we have flexible solutions, and the intention is really to help maximize the value of the investments that have already been made. But I'm excited to see how this conversation has evolved, and I think that maybe this would be something we could pick up in a year's time.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I could have gone on for a lot longer, and I'm hoping that our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
Thank you. Thank you both.
You've been listening to Seismic Sessions, enabling the financial services industry. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date with the latest opinions on all things revenue enablement within the financial sector.